Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, September 11, 2018. The warring parties in South Sudan are expected to sign a final peace deal.
The delegates are moving from Khartoum to Addis, and it's expected that the Council of Ministers of the EGAD countries will meet tomorrow in the morning. And also in the afternoon, there will be a meeting of the heads of states and government, and they will deliberate on the final text of the agreement.
And a human rights defender says conflict and corruption goes hand in hand.
Until the Security Council and other interested parties with potential influence can create leverage to change these dynamics, the bottom line is that war will remain more beneficial than peace for those at the center of conflict and corruption.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's warring parties and civil society delegates have traveled to the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa to witness the signing of the revitalized peace agreement to end 5 years of fighting in South Sudan. Rebel leader Riek Machar also traveled to Addis Ababa this morning to take part in the signing of the peace deal, which is expected on Wednesday. Rajab Mohandis, a civil society delegate who has been attending the negotiations in Khartoum, says the warring parties are serious this time about ending the conflict in South Sudan.
The delegates are moving from Khartoum to Addis, and it's expected that the Council of Ministers of the EGAD countries will meet tomorrow in the morning, and also in the afternoon there will be a meeting of the heads of states and government. And they will deliberate on the proposed, the final text of the agreement, and also discuss the outstanding issues which were forwarded to the EGAD leadership. And if all these issues are addressed in the meetings tomorrow, then the agreement will be ready for signing in the afternoon or so of tomorrow.
And what is the mood among the delegates who are with you right now at Khartoum International Airport, boarding the plane to Addis Ababa?
Well, of course, there are some few of these issues which have not been finalized, but the delegates appear to be hopeful, and we're getting there to see how it will all go. But definitely there is some bit of hope that maybe these things will be finalized and the agreement will be signed tomorrow.
Yeah, but there are issues that have not been resolved. There are several issues. For instance, the boundaries of the states, the quorum for meeting, and the drafting of the constitution. These issues seem to be very key to some of the parties to this conflict. Are you hopeful that the agreement will be signed with these reservations?
Yes, these issues are key to some of the parties, and they were forwarded to the leadership of EGAD, particularly the Council of Ministers, just before they went to Beijing. And so in that process of their meeting in Beijing, they also had some consultations on this, and some discussions have been going on since then to get these issues addressed so that by tomorrow, they will be finalized to prepare the agreement for signing.
And where is Dr. Riek Machar and President Salva Kiir as we speak with you? Do you know where they are?
Dr. Riek Machar was here also this morning, and he left for Addis. And I think he should be in Addis by now. And yeah.
What about President Kiir? Do you know where he is? What are his delegates telling you where he is?
Of course, I have no idea where he is, but I expect him to be in Addis as well.
And so, from tomorrow, once the parties sign the agreement, the D-Day kicks in. That is the start of the implementation of this agreement. Am I correct?
Yes. As soon as the agreement is signed, that will mark the D-Day, and the clock will begin to tick for implementation.
And what is the difference between this agreement and the one that collapsed in 2015? What is the difference?
Well, there are quite a lot of differences. First, this agreement provides for 8 months of free transition period, and within these 8 months, there will be cantonment and reorganization of the army, of the forces, training, and it will culminate with unification and deployment of these forces. So as for the past agreement of 2015, there was only 3 months of pre-transition period and about 18 months of unification of the forces. But this time, we have 8 months of transition period, which will be mainly for transitional security arrangements, reorganizing, training, and deploying, unifying and deploying the different forces in the country. And of course, this time the arrangements are also a little bit different. We have a more expanded government than we had in 2015.
What about other groups that refused to initial some parts of the agreement that was negotiated in Khartoum? What is their faith? For instance, the National Salvation Front, they refused to be part of the agreement. What is their faith?
Well, I think this guy, the National Salvation Front and the People's Democratic Party, until Saturday and Sunday, they released the statement not agreeing to the text of the agreement as it is, because it misses out quite a number of their demands. However, some of them seem to have split, like the National Salvation Front, and with us here now, some of their members who are actually a kind of a splinter group. So they are also going to add it in this plane with us.
All right, Raja Mohandis, thank you very much for giving us that update, and we wish you a safe flight to Addis Ababa.
Thank you.
That's Raja Mohandis speaking with me from Khartoum International Airport before boarding a flight to Addis Ababa this past hour. The ENAF project told the United Nations Security Council on Monday that there is a close link between corruption and the ongoing conflict in South Sudan. The founding director of the ENAF project told the council members that there is no coordinated strategy to disrupt illicit flows. Ayen Deng Bior has the story from Washington.
John Prendergast told the Security Council Monday that there is a direct connection between corruption and mass atrocities, arguing that war economies are propped up by illicit self-enrichment. Prendergast says the Security Council has an important role to play.
Until the Security Council and other interested parties with potential influence can create leverage to change these dynamics, the bottom line is that war will remain more beneficial than peace for those at the center of conflict and corruption. The same people benefiting from war economies are often the power brokers in peace talks and have limited incentive, in fact, sometimes no incentive, to reach and implement a negotiated settlement, especially if adhering to such an agreement means losing out economically.
Prendergast says there isn't a uniform strategy to create the leverage to fight corruption. Speaking at the same session of a Security Council meeting at UN headquarters in New York, Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, says the Council rarely talks about how corruption fuels conflict. She says corruption is a global issue that directly impacts countries like South Sudan.
Corruption sustains and prolongs conflict. The ethnic divisions in South Sudan are real, but the driving source of the conflict is a fight over who will control South Sudan's oil revenues, as we heard earlier today. Until there is a way to transparently distribute natural resources in a way that is seen fair by the South Sudanese people, the civil war will go on.
Out of 180 countries worldwide, South Sudan was ranked 179th in Transparency International's latest corruption index. The report's authors found that activists and the media are vital to combating corruption. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres echoed this sentiment.
Governments can also enhance anti-corruption efforts by ensuring independent judiciaries, a vibrant civil society, freedom of the media, and effective whistleblower protection. The international community can complement these efforts by working more effectively against money laundering, tax evasion, and the illicit financial flows that have privated countries of much-needed resources.
Prendergast says there are a number of steps council members can take to curb corruption around the world, and he urged the council to enact sanctions on financial networks, not just individuals.
These network sanctions work because they affect not only the primary target of the sanctions themselves, but also the individuals and companies who play an important role in supporting the target's activities. By sanctioning individuals and entities all at once or in close succession and ensuring robust enforcement, which is key, the primary target's network does not have enough time to recover from the financial impact of being cut off from the global financial system.
The Council should add corruption tied to conflict as a sanctions criteria, according to Prendergast. And he says the UN should consider expanding a relationship with anti-money laundering bodies. He says both national and international courts should be included in the solution.
The courts must have the mandate to prosecute financial crimes, particularly those rooted in corruption, when connected to conflict and atrocities. The ICC and other courts of special jurisdiction, such as the Special Criminal Court for Central African Republic or the Hybrid Court in South Sudan, must have the authority to prosecute these financial crimes.
A hybrid court in South Sudan, the parameters of which are outlined in the 2015 peace agreement, has yet to be formed. Transparency International's report reveals many countries with low civil liberties tend to be high in corruption. The report found a similar relationship between press freedoms and countries with high corruption rates. It recommended that governments reduce regulations on the media and increase access to information for civil society groups. Ayan Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
The head of South Sudan's Parliamentary Committee on Transport, Roads and Bridges has summoned the National Minister of Transport to explain the cause of Sunday's plane crash that killed 20 passengers. Relatives of some of the victims say they want people to be held accountable. Dengai Deng has more for VOA from Bor.
Makur Jemidachuoth, who is originally from Yerul but resides in Bor, says he lost two relatives in the crash, including a seven-month-old baby.
I was shocked. We were all saddened and shocked by the news. And I got up in the morning. I have one of my close relatives who happened to be my in-law, my sister-in-law. I lost her with a child, and it was really a very sad moment for me.
Achuoth says Juba must carry out an investigation and hold people responsible, especially the owners of the airline company and civil aviation officials, for life lost.
There must be some rules and regulations that regulates the flight movement. And if at all such incident happens, something has to be done. And again, of course, it is something that we would want our government actually to follow up critically. And we also have to do something in terms of our quality check system. Most of the operators in South Sudan, I'm not really very sure if there's proper licensing.
Akwi Makoy, who also hails from Yerul but lives in Bor, says his nephew was injured in the crash.
It is a great loss for people of Eastern Lake and the entire South Sudan. If you can see such a death, it is not a death that we can even talk about. The way even I feel when I heard about the incident, I was like getting mad, because the death, including children and the elders. But when I got a lot of communication, told some of the colleagues that this is what had happened, because I have some of the relatives with us here in Bor, I passed the information to them immediately. And we were like, we gave that. And then to have a small prayers for such an incident.
John Majuk of Yerul says his cousin died in the plane crash.
I'm feeling very sad because what have happened to our state is really very worse. So we should not lose this number. So this is very sad news anyway. Yes, of course, I need the compensation, but it should be quickly.
Majuk agrees with Makoy that the South Civil Aviation Authority and the airline company must pay compensation to the families of the victims. They are also calling on the national government and the Civil Aviation Authority to enact strict regulations to prevent similar accidents from happening in the future. South Sudan in Focus reached out to officials with the airline company Southwest Aviation, which owned the 19-seat plane that crashed in Irul Lake, but those calls were not answered. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, health officials in the DRC say they have the latest Ebola outbreak under control. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
have you ever been stereotyped?
The stereotypic thing is always there around our society, given the kind of people you associate with. Others will feel, look at you and despise you because of the level you are in. But the most important thing is that I always prove them wrong because my life keeps changing into the better every day.
Yes, it happened when we were in a refugee camp in Uganda. People have been calling us, we are refugees. So that is mostly the way which has been stereotyped me most.
Not at all. As an individual, never been stereotyped. But people normally say South Sudanese, they are people who are arrogant and something like that.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. And today, we are talking about containing the latest Ebola outbreak in neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. The health ministry in the DRC says the outbreak is under control in the epicenter of the northeast part of the country. But smaller clusters of cases are causing concern, including up to four in the nearby trading center of Butembo, a city of about 1 million people near the border with Uganda. Peter Salama, the World Health Organization's Deputy Director General in charge of emergencies, spoke with my colleague Paul Alexander about the status of the country's 10th outbreak and the challenges of keeping it from crossing the borders.
Yeah, the current situation is that we now have 131 confirmed and probable cases and 90 deaths. The last 3 weeks have certainly seen a reduction in number of cases, although there was a mild increase in recent days. And what we've seen is that around 15 of the last 24 confirmed cases have come from one particular index case. So they're all related to an area near Beni called Ndindi. And that area has seen, for several particular reasons, the majority of recent cases. And then the other major development has been, of course, the confirmation of cases in the city of Butembo, where we are very concerned because it's a city of somewhere around 1 million people. And we've had now one confirmed cases and two probable cases in that city. And there is one additional suspicious case. So that city is certainly something we're following very closely and rapidly now, scaling up our response measures. Apart from that, when we go back and look at the trends and the original epicenters of the outbreak around Mangina and Beni, we're seeing that cases are indeed declining in those areas. The response is making steady progress, but there are, as we know with Ebola outbreaks, there is almost always a sting in the tail, as we say, and we're certainly seeing that sting, which is complicating the recent couple of weeks.
So that would sort of reflect the DRC's health ministry saying that the outbreak is under control because it appears to be in Beni and elsewhere, although there must be some concerns about Butembo and the other town.
So I certainly share the sentiment that we're making strong progress, particularly around the original epicenters of Beni and Mangina. But as I said, there's still reason to be quite concerned about the ongoing cluster in Ndindi, and particularly about the new recently confirmed cases in and around Butembo, because they're quite new, and we're still doing full contact tracing on those cases in Butembo, and we haven't yet vaccinated even the full list of contacts that we have there in Butembo. So it's still early days to say that Butembo, at least, is under control.
What are the challenges of preventing Ebola from jumping borders to nearby Uganda, Rwanda, and Sudan?
So there's enormous challenges. As you know, this part of northern Kivu has a lot of movement of population, both forced displacements, around 1 million people of the 8 million population of North Kivu are internally displaced persons, but also travel, voluntary travel, particularly for commercial and trade reasons. So we know that some of the cross-border sites, such as Kasindi, see up to 10 to 20,000 people crossing in either direction every day. So it's an enormous, as you can imagine, exercise to screen that level of population movement across the border, particularly with Uganda, but also to some extent with Rwanda particularly.
That's Peter Salama, WHO's Deputy Director General in charge of emergencies, speaking to VOA's Paul Alexander on Monday. From DRC, we move to Rwanda. Rwanda's last census of mountain gorillas was done in 2016, putting the number of the animals to 604. Their numbers had fallen as low as 242 in 1981. As part of its efforts to protect the rare species, since 2005, Rwanda has held annual events to name babies apes. Tourists say the celebrations foster a relationship between the animals and humans, and that helps lead to sustainable conservation. This year's ceremony was held under the theme, Conservation is Life. Eugene Iyumana reports for VOA from Kigali.
Actually, I have chosen a Chinese name. The name is Wan Wan.
There is China's ambassador to Rwanda, Rao Hongwei, but he's naming a human newborn. He's naming a baby mountain gorilla, one of 23 born in the past year, named last week in Rwanda. The Rwandan government regularly invites foreign dignitaries and tourists to gather for annual gorilla baby naming ceremonies. They more than take on the traditional gatherings human families hold to welcome newborns. This year, Olusegun Obasanjo, the former president for Nigeria, named one baby gorilla, Aremu, a name he borrows from his own names.
And if all countries will go this way, setting out a day in the year, celebrate a particular animal or plant, I think we will have a world where there will be no problem of climate change.
New Zealander Nicholas Groenwegen and Canadian Alexa Gray took part in the ceremony.
So by allowing people to name gorillas, it allows people to have that personal touch.
And we visited gorillas. I've been lucky enough to trek with them 3 times now, and it doesn't matter how many times you go, it's incredible every time you get to see them. It's very magical. There's nothing else like it.
Many Rwandans living near the Volcanoes National Park say the gorillas living there are an important resource.
The gorillas are helping us to improve our life because when tourists come in Rwanda, they buy our products and our life comes better.
How would be your market if there were not gorillas?
It wouldn't be easy for us.
The Chief Executive Officer of Rwanda Development Board, Claire Kamanzi, says those visitors are important to the economy.
In particular, tourism was chosen as one of the sectors that had the potential to drive Rwanda's economic transformation. We aim to double tourism to $800 million and to ensure that tourism in Rwanda is very much underpinned by a very strong focus of conservation.
The Development Board says tourism last year brought in $438 million and gorillas contribute about 90% of tourism revenues in the national parks. By 2024, Rwanda aims to expand the Volcanoes National Park by almost 20%, which could help the gorilla population grow 15 to 20%. The park dates back to 1925, when a small area between Kalisimbi, Bisoke and Mikendo Mountains was set aside to protect the gorillas. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali.
From Kigali, we move to South Africa, where the largest agricultural organization in that country says most of its white farmers are committed to helping to establish more black farmers in the country. The African National Congress government recently announced it would amend the constitution to allow it to confiscate farmlands without compensating its white owners. But the Agri-SA group, which represents tens of thousands of the country's white and black farmers, say such radical move isn't necessary in order to achieve land reforms in South Africa. Darren Taylor reports.
Sheena O'Connell's first contact with forced removals came when apartheid officials kicked her family out of their home in the late 1960s.
My earliest memories, in fact, are of District 6 and of my grandparents being removed to the Cape Flats.
Like thousands of other black people, generations of her family were pushed to the windswept, impoverished Cape Flats. Today, O'Connell's a professor of humanities and African studies at the universities of Pretoria and Colgate in New York. She's researched the experiences of South Africans forced off their land.
It's the same story over and over again. One of unmitigated loss. One of a memory that shifts and changes all the time, because that's what memory is. It's not absolutely fixed. And one of a need to tell a story and for somebody to listen.
In most of the stories, says O'Connell, there's a big gap.
They can come up with all kinds of stories of what happened before, and they can remember life afterwards in their new home. But you ask them about that actual move, and there is an absolute block.
O'Connell says South Africa's approach to land restitution needs a fundamental shift.
We need to make the space in this country to understand that the question of land is much more than just attending to it in terms of a return to a piece of land or money. There has to be something else that addresses this trauma. Otherwise, it's going to remain a blight on the psyche of our nation.
O'Connell cites the country's first land restitution case 22 years ago at Eland's Kloof in Western Cape Province.
We are surrounded by these mountains, by this landscape that is almost otherworldly. Like in a Mad Max movie. So sitting in this hollow, in this valley, you see the beauty of the space juxtaposed by the realities of poverty.
In 1996, Nelson Mandela's ANC triumphantly returned Eland's Kloof to hundreds of blacks driven from their homes to make way for white farmers. The ensuing celebrations were a powerful symbol of the new democratic South Africa. But today, says O'Connell, there's little joy to be found at Eland's Kloof.
You see the aged women literally sleeping in the bush in broken down vehicles, resorting to picking up acorns to sell for animal or pig feed, picking up dry flowers that they can sell for next to nothing as tourist trinkets.
O'Connell says just as the white supremacists abused the people of Eland's Kloof, so too did the ANC. It dumped them back on land they could no longer farm. Strict controls over their traditional rooibos or red bush tea crop prevent them from raising it. And O'Connell says they don't have the political or infrastructural backing anyway. O'Connell says many other land restitution cases echo the Eland's Kloof experience, leaving the beneficiaries still mired in poverty. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
That report by Darren Taylor brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song As-Salaam Wasal by a group from Sudan's Blue Nile State. We've been listening to a test of that music from a group from Blue Nile State. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.